From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire.
Welcome to the program. You know, I've always believed that life and death are closely entwined. One must learn to die well as one must learn to live well. Well, after helping her significant other, Brent, go through 18 months of living with and eventually dying from esophageal cancer, Claire Goldsberry wanted to share not only a story of fearless living and graceful dying, but also include the broader picture of what living fearlessly and dying gracefully means for all of us. As a hospice volunteer for 2 years after Brent's death, she became acutely aware of just how important it is not only for the dying person and the person's family and friends to understand living and dying. Well, in her new book, The Illusion of Life and Death, Mind, Consciousness, and Eternal Being, Claire Goldsberry has experienced Protestant Christianity, Mormonism, the ageless wisdom teachings, Gnosticism, Hinduism, and Buddhism. She writes about religion and spiritual traditions for Quest magazine and other publications. Her book, A Stranger in Zion, A Christian's Journey Through the Heart of Utah Mormonism, won the Arizona Book Publishers Association's Award for Best Religion Book in 2003. Goldsberry has also published 6 books on marketing and sales strategies for small to mid-sized manufacturing companies, and she founded her own marketing and public relations business in 1989. She lives and works in Arizona, and it's from that beautiful state that she joins us today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard.
You know, it's interesting. Life and death are part of the same coin. And yet, with the books, with the death cafes, with Tuesdays with Maury, with so much information out there, people still have a lot of fear about death. You talk a lot about fear in this book. Why is overcoming fear important to living and to having a good death?
Well, I believe that fear, to a great extent, is an obstacle, both to living life fully and well, and also to learning to have a good death. Fear is one of the three poisons in Buddhism. And I understand why it's a poison, because fear truly does prevent us from living the life we need to live or living the life we want to live. Mm-hmm. We usually have the greatest fear is the fear of the loss of our bodies, because that's what we most identify with is my body. And we identify so strongly with our bodies that overcoming this fear is truly an exercise in mindfulness or practice of controlling the mind, allowing our mind to be peaceful and not allowing our emotions to run away with us.
Yeah.
And just embracing all as the path. I kept a diary, kind of a journal, of my significant other, Brent, after he was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. And he was rather young. He was 59 years old when he was diagnosed. And I went through an 18-month process with him. And what I learned is that he knew not only how to live, which is one of the things I loved about him, but he also knew how to die. I had just begun studying Buddhism 6 years before. And so I was just getting into this idea of the process of death and dying and what it is, something I'd never experienced when I was being raised in the Judeo-Christian traditions. And so I began seeing around me people that didn't know how to die and the fear of death and what the fear of death does to us. And how it prevents us from really living well.
Yeah.
And I came to this idea that if you know how to die, you know how to live well. If you know how to die well, you know how to live well. And so I thought that something needed to be written about death and dying, not from specifically one viewpoint, but maybe viewpoints that encompassed Christianity, the Eastern philosophies, the ancient philosophers, and that sort of thing. So I wrote this book to try to help people see life differently, perhaps live life differently, so that they can have a better death.
Mm-hmm. Were you with Brent when he died?
Yes.
What was that?
He died here at home.
What was that like for you when he took his last breath? What emotions?
You know, actually, by this point, after 18 months of walking this journey with him, mm-hmm. I felt very peaceful about it. I learned that one of the difficult things for people who are dying is people around them get so upset and so because they're so strongly attached to the person.
Yes.
Attachment is an ego thing. I was also a hospice volunteer for a couple of years after Brent died, and one of the things that I saw firsthand was the way people would get so upset when the person was dying, instead of feeling the peace in allowing the person to take their last breath, to die the way they needed to die, and not inject yourself into that process and get so upset over it. And so I think that that's one of the things that I wanted to express to people, that you can love someone, you can have compassion for people, but you don't have to get so involved in the process that you can't allow the person to do what they need to do in the dying process.
Yes. You use the term, a term that other people have used too, but you use that term, good death. But what does a good death look like for you, and how do you prepare for a good death?
Well, I think that watching Brent through this process, he continued to work up until about 3 weeks before he died. Mm-hmm. He was in sales, and so I watched that, and I learned a lot just from that. What is a good death? I came to believe that a good death is a death without fear. And again, a good death is really about living in such a way that we really don't cling so tightly to life with a fear of losing our bodies, that we resist these events that confront us.
Yeah.
When Brent was diagnosed with esophageal cancer, he just sort of looked at me and smiled and said, "Well, this should be another excellent adventure." And I was kind of shocked, because I was the one that, after the doctor gave us the diagnosis, I was just stunned. It was like somebody had just like ripped me open, and I didn't know, you know, what to do. And Brent was just like, "Oh, well, just another excellent adventure."
Yeah.
And that was really the beginning of my learning experience about what a good death might look like. And of course, studying Buddhism, we study a lot about death, about the dying process. And I think that helped a lot as well. Mm-hmm. But watching Brent's last day here at home, it was very enlightening to watch how easy it was for him. And I think it was because he never had any fear of it. He never tried to fight it. He never suffered, really, because he didn't want life to be different than it is.
Yes.
And the Buddha's second noble truth, the Buddha says, we only suffer when we want things to be different than they are. And Brent always said, I never wanted anything to be different than it is in my life.
Hmm.
And that made a big difference.
You write that when Brent was near death, he said to me, "Dying is easy. I thought it would be harder than this, but it's so easy. And that is what it's like to have a good death." What was it about Brent and his upbringing, or perhaps things he was learning in his adult life, that helped him to come to that place in his life where he could embrace his own death like he did?
Well, I think probably he was just born that way. He probably carried that over from a previous life,
okay,
or many previous lives.
Uh-huh.
He never really had a religious upbringing. He, by the time I had met him, and he had never professed any particular religious or spiritual beliefs. But every now and then he would say things, say something. I can't right off the top of my head think of one as an example, but he would say something and I would go, "That's a very Buddhist thought." And he'd go, "Oh, really? Well, I didn't know that." Of course, he didn't know anything about Buddhism except that it was something that I was involved in and had studied.
Yes.
So I think it was just the way he was. He was just one of these people that just never had any fear of things. His father had died of stomach cancer when he was 16. And even that, I could say, well, that might have had some influence on the way he felt, but not really.
Yeah.
It was different for Brent. He just sort of embraced it, and that's the way it was.
Well, people say we die as we live, and it sounds like that's how it was with Brent. That's just how he lived.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. For those who don't have that easy surrendering kind of thing in their life, I've learned so much about death and dying from a lot of amazing Buddhist teachers, so from Buddhism as well. You've already talked about that yourself. How does, though, Buddhism, for those who aren't familiar with any of the teachings, but how does Buddhism help us prepare for death?
Well, one of the things that amazed me when I first started studying Buddhism and then found a local sangha to attend was the focus on death. They focus on death almost as much as they focus on life. And one of the meditations we used to do periodically, not every week, but was a meditation on our own death, what it would be like, how it would feel to allow the mind to move up the central channel and exit at the top of one's head. This whole process of just imagining what that would be like, and to learn not to fear it, but to allow the process to be what it is. And I'd never experienced anything like that before, because typically Christians, and I was raised just mainstream Protestant Christian, we never talked much about it. About the only time we talked about death was at Easter,
yeah,
and that was about the death of Jesus.
Exactly.
And nothing was ever really explored about the dying process and about what happens. And I think that's what people fear the most is, I don't want to have pain. Well, I have pain. How do I know what is beyond this life? Is there anything?
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be the end of my body and the end of me? Again, that ego attachment,
Yes.
So I think that's what people fear, and I think Buddhism, because of its focus on life, death, and learning to have different perspectives on life and death, seeing all phenomenon differently and seeing life differently helps us to see death differently,
mm-hmm,
and certainly in a different way than I would say mainstream Judeo-Christianity would look at it.
I would so agree. As a former pastor and as someone who I guess I would consider myself very much a Christian, but I embrace Buddhist principles and some Native American principles. I'm very broad-based. I've always been surprised that there's not, to my knowledge, any Christian authors out there who have yet written a book, let alone a decent book, on death. Most of them have come from a Buddhist perspective.
That is interesting, isn't it? I never thought about that, but you're right. And again, I think it's because Christians don't have this in-depth way of looking at life, the mind, consciousness. You know, when they teach you about life, life is not separate, inherently existent phenomena, but everything is created in the mind by the mind.
Yes.
Nothing is inherently existent from its own side. And so you begin to adopt that and realize that even our bodies are not inherently existent. Even our bodies are created in the mind. And as I began studying quantum physics, I began to also see that way of looking at things, that things are not inherently existent, that we create everything around us. We create the material world. But I think that one of the reasons we don't see a lot of Christian books on death is they don't really understand it. And in fact, there's a funny thing that I heard years ago. It said, you know, all Christians want to go to heaven. They just don't want to die to get there.
Yeah, that's probably right.
That's probably very true, right?
Yeah. Well, you're mentioning words like consciousness and quantum physics. It's interesting because early on in our country, we had some of the greatest New Thought leaders, Thoreau, Emerson, Walt Whitman,
who taught
and spoke about what you're teaching. Now, on this radio show, I've had a lot of authors writing on quantum physics and consciousness. In this book, The Illusion of Life and Death, you mention consciousness and quantum physics as relative to Buddhist philosophy. Can you share more about that unique relationship?
Well, again, it's this idea of mind. That has been a new idea for me in when I began studying Buddhism, is mind. Growing up in Christianity, the word soul was used a lot. Mm-hmm. And the Greek word for soul is psyche, yeah, which we use in connection with mind. And when you look at what quantum physics teaches, that there is no inherent reality, we just see things as inherently separate. You out there, me in here, we see the things that we experience as outside of ourselves, when in reality, everything comes from within. You have, say, for example, Schrodinger's observer effect, that everything we observe, we are creating the way that is perceived. The observer always has an effect on what is being observed. I like to use the example of movie projectors, the old-time film strips, you know, that ran on the reels and the movie projectors.
Yes.
And everything that we see as being out there, and my favorite quantum physicist, Fred Allen Wolf, says there is no out there,
yes,
which Buddhists would very much agree with. Everything is like a frame. Everything is arising and falling away nanosecond by nanosecond, kind of like a film strip running through a projector. When you look at the strip, you see the individual frames. When you run it through a projector using light and energy, it all looks like it's real and moving and here, and it's out there, and you're in here, and you're observing it. When in actuality, we're creating it.
Yes. Yes, and you know, it was when I started interpreting the teachings of Jesus from a metaphysical lens.
Mm-hmm.
So when Jesus says, you are the light, what if he meant, baby, you're the light. You are light. The kind of thing that we're learning from quantum physics and some of the other passages. Actually, it brought me even closer to Jesus because he was an Easterner. He taught from an Eastern perspective, but unfortunately, without getting into church history, because that's the topic of our, you know, the books that made the cut, the books that didn't make the cut. But I think even Jesus had an understanding of this. Now, getting back to Buddhism, some of the greatest lessons I've learned from Buddhism is non-attachment and also impermanence.
Right.
So let's talk about What is the practice of non-attachment, and how can this practice help us have a good death?
Well, as I've mentioned, we are attached to our bodies. Probably first and foremost, we're attached to our bodies.
Yeah.
We really like these vehicles. And I think that learning non-attachment is very difficult. That's something I've never heard of before until I began studying Buddhism, is attachment and how attachment is the root of suffering. And when you look at attachment, fear of loss plays a big role in there. Everything we're attached to, we're afraid of losing.
Yes.
And so fear plays a big part in the attachments that we have to our bodies, our relationships, our material possessions, everything. And learning non-attachment is not easy. I know when I have taught classes on it and tried to explain it to people, it's like, well, you can't be non-attached. If you love your spouse, you're going to be very attached to them. If you love your children, you're going to be very attached to them. But it's the attachment that causes the suffering. And to learn non-attachment is to learn to remove your ego from it. Attachment involves a lot of ego. You know, my spouse, my children, my house, my car.
Yes.
And I think that
my
country, ego.
Yes.
And learning to see things as impermanent,
yeah,
knowing that from minute to minute to minute, everything changes. All is mutable. And when you know that and you can realize that, I mean, you have to realize it like on this deep level, that things change and you must embrace the change if you're going to practice non-attachment.
Learning it on a deep level. I love that, what you just shared. And it reminds me, at least in my journey, when I started reaching out to other teachings and hanging out with these beautiful Buddhist monks down in Bloomington, Indiana, because there's a couple of different monasteries down there, and in the books that I've been reading, you start gaining the knowledge. How I word it is, you start gaining that knowledge. It's in your head. It's knowledge. But as you begin to meditate on it, as you begin to read more about it, as you begin to practice it, then it drops from your head into your heart, and your heart becomes illumination, and that's when the life changes come. Richard Rohr, Father Richard Rohr, would say, it's about experience, not knowledge. Experiencing
exactly
all of that. And what you're saying is right on. If people would begin to learn more about that and try to implement that in their lives, then when that day comes, and it will, we will all die, we will be better prepared for our own death.
Yes, absolutely. And you're right. It's one thing just to know about something. Mm-hmm. We can all read books and we can go, oh, yeah, I read this book about death and dying. But ultimately, you do have to come to this, what I would call a gnosis or a deep knowing.
Yes.
About what that is. And often that only comes when you have that experience, when you are faced with a medical diagnosis that is going to change your life or your loved one's life or both of your lives. When you experience that, then you begin to realize at a really deep level what this really means. And you go from this intellectual head learning, I read a book on that, to the heart level. And what does this really mean for me? And what are my lessons here that I need to learn? What is this experience going to do to transform me and make me a better person?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's so true. The other thing that fascinates me about this broad topic of death, and it reminds me of your subtitle, which I love, of this book, Mind, Consciousness, and Eternal Being, and that is, oh, yeah, what about afterlife? So let's say I've died, and let's say I've died a good death, but where do we go? So if you could share with the listeners here, what do we know about life after death?
Well, to be honest, we don't know a whole lot.
Yes.
I never will forget one time somebody in our class at the Buddhist Center ask the teacher that, you know. So it's like, okay, so we're talking about death, you know. What happens after we die? And the teacher just very straightforward said, we don't know. So it's like, well, maybe we have some of the answers, but maybe not all of the answers. I think this unknowing, this fear of the unknown, again, it has to do with me and mine and I and who am I.
Yes.
And what will happen to this I after, you know, I no longer have a body as a vehicle in which to operate. I think that near-death experiences that have been recorded over the past many decades has helped us understand somewhat what might happen after we die. Mm-hmm. I don't think we can say absolutely what happens. I think that creating a good life will help us have a good death. Mm-hmm. And I think we can carry that through into our afterlife or our life between births, our life between death and death.
Yes.
I think the one example I used was the gentleman, Howard Storm, who wrote the book My Descent into Death. Mm-hmm. And other people have talked about all the light, the joy, and the love that they experienced in their near-death experience. And he did not experience that. He experienced these monsters that tore at him and, you know, were violent toward him until he realized that those monsters were of his own creation. That was his ego. That was his discontent at just being an art teacher at a university and not being a great artist like he always imagined he wanted to be. And the minute he saw that his own ego had created the monsters, they disappeared. So I think we do have some influence on what we will experience. Again, it is in the mind.
Yeah.
The mind creates everything we experience.
That's interesting, that the story you shared in your book and what you just referred to, because he brought all that torment, all that frustration, all the emotions that came with that, without dealing with it, without letting it go, he brought it into his death. And it probably influenced his experience. I'm fascinated by this because your initial answer, I so agree. We don't know. As a matter of fact, the older I get, the less I know. But I think about, I had a conversation with Anita Mirjani on the show, Annie Kagan, who wrote Afterlife of Billy Fingers, and actually it was Billy talking to her after he died, or even a David Kessler, an international grief expert. Now, he said about afterlife, and again, these are all just people's either personal experiences or their opinion. Mm-hmm. David had an interesting twist on it. He said, he kind of figures that maybe the afterlife will be what we want it to be based on our beliefs. A Christian will see Jesus. A Buddhist will probably see Buddha. A Native American will experience something Native American. And I sat with that for a while and I thought, well, again, that's speaking of the mind, just like you are.
Exactly.
But then Ibn Alexander, who wrote his book, and he was atheist, he had kind of a similar experience as Anita Mirjani. It was bliss, unconditional love, law, Jeff, you know. But then I've known some Christian authors in the past, fundamental Christian authors, who will talk about hell. And then I thought, well, maybe they were in churches where the turn and burn, the turn or burn message was taught a lot. And it's stuck in their mind. So I think you're on to something there. Yeah, our mind.
Yeah, I think so. I think the mind creates everything. You know, all is created in the mind by the mind. And I think that's certainly true. I've heard that heaven and hell aren't really places as they are states of mind.
I can attest
you know,
to that.
Nirvana.
Yes.
You know, you said, well, are we going to Nirvana?
Yes.
Well, do we really go anywhere?
Right.
You know, go to hell. Life can be Nirvana. Depending on how we perceive it, depending on how we perceive all the events of our lives, it can be nirvana, it can be hell, depending on how we look at life. Some people see their life as absolute hell. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to go anywhere to experience. It's right here, right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think the way we think and the way we perceive definitely gives us all these perceptions of our experiences. And our experiences will always reflect how we think, because thoughts become reality.
There's so much truth to that, and the mind is such an amazing thing. We're using the word mind, we're using the word consciousness. Explain, if you will, explain consciousness and the difference between the mind and the brain.
Well, I like to explain the difference between the mind and the brain by saying the brain is the computer hardware.
Ah.
The mind is the software.
Oh, I like that.
We all have a brain, and all of our brains are pretty much alike. Einstein's brain was given to science after he died, and they were going to look at his brain and determine why he was so smart. And they looked, but they didn't find anything that's much different than every other brain. So the mind is what gives us our perceptions. We can look at a Picasso painting, for example, and our senses that, you know, our brain is connected to all of our senses. Our senses can tell us that's a painting and Picasso did it, and it's got various colors and shapes. And my mind tells me that is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. That is really an ugly painting. And the person standing next to me says, I love that. It's the most beautiful painting I ever saw.
Yeah.
And so that's the real difference, is it's mind is the software that gives us our perceptions, even gives us our feelings about things.
Hmm.
So I think that's an easy way to look at brain-mind.
Hmm. That's well said. I'm thinking about something else. I'll just jump in here with that. How does one prepare for death that is peaceful and one without fear? And then I want to throw in something in that question also. What are your views or thoughts about the right to die laws?
Okay.
That some states have and most don't.
Yeah. Well, I think how does one have a good death? I think, Seneca said dying peacefully is dying willingly. You must be aware that death is always just right on our right shoulder. That any time, death is certain, the time of our death is uncertain, as I heard so many times at the Buddhist Center. And that's so true. It's true for all of us. We do not know. And I think that learning to die well involves just being able to embrace what comes when it comes.
Yes.
And the right to die laws, I've changed my mind a little bit about mm-hmm. some of those. Mm-hmm. I used to think that euthanasia would be a good option. And it may be for some people. I don't deny that. But for me, watching Brent go through the dying process, and I must say I had the book, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Right there by my side. Watching, reading what's happening now. And I told him, I said, I'm sure glad you're dying by the book, so I know what's going on. And that made it easier on me for sure. But I began to realize, especially after he died and I reflected on it, that there's value in the dying process.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just me.
Yes.
I think that it's different for everybody. I don't think anybody should say what's right or wrong for another person. But I have come to the conclusion that there is some value in that dying process.
And maybe it depends on how the person is dying.
Good, yeah.
Because I recognize when we're talking about, like, right to die, there's a fine line there. And I know they try to walk it by having a doctor involved in that, and I think maybe a psychiatrist or psychologist involved in that decision. Last week, I got a call from a friend who I hadn't talked to in years, although I got her emails, and she had been a ballet dancer, not belly dancer, and but then on a spiritual path, a very deep spiritual path, and became a channeler. And that became worldwide, and that's when I got on her emails, and I would follow her on Facebook. But I got a call from a Canadian number, and I was actually seeing a hospice patient, and I didn't answer it because I thought, yeah, a Canadian call, that's going to be a bogus call. And then the voicemail kicked in. So I went into a dining area, no patients were there, and I clicked it, and it was my friend Judith. And she wanted me to call her back, and I said, Judith? Really? What? So I called her back right away. And long story short, she wanted to call me to let me know that she was in a hospice house now, personally, and she had been diagnosed with ALS. And that she was dying, and that the disease, which to me is one of the most dreaded diseases anyone can have, it was creeping up her body, and now it was where her lungs were. And so she recognized that now was a time to call people that meant a difference in her life while she could. But she told me that in Canada, the whole nation has that law. And so she already signed the paperwork because she didn't want to have to suffocate. So I guess I share that because it probably depends on how a person is dying.
I think you're right. I think you're right. Yeah, that's... Yes, I've read about people with ALS. I think that was Tuesdays with Maury that had ALS. That was like heart-wrenching to read that book.
Yes.
And I do think that it depends on, you know, the circumstances of the person's body, and because it can be quite painful. And I think I would have to agree with her that if there is a bit of an easier way, that would certainly should be an option, I think, for everybody.
Yeah. There's a word, and you talk about this in your book, that, to be honest, I sometimes have a hard time understanding. My very best friend, John, who's a psychology professor, believes in this, and we talk about it. But I've never really delved deep in it, and that is karma. Can you discuss karma and how it helps explain our life's path, the good, but also the bad, without blaming God for bad things and praising Him for the good things?
Well, karma is often misunderstood by Westerners. And I've talked to a number of Hindu philosophers, and one of my favorites, Ravi Ravindra. We've discussed karma, and I do believe that it's misunderstood. Karma is just action. There's no judgment on it. It's not like good action, bad action. It's just action. And karma is perfect justice because we actually create the life we have through karma. Intention is everything. And so when you look at karma, you can say, well, something turned out badly, but the intention was that, you know, I was going to do a good thing, but it turned out badly. We don't like to accept our karmic consequences. I know people that just reject karma out of hand, but I tell them, you know, karma is like gravity. It works whether you believe in it or not. And, you know, step out in front of a bus and tell me that, you know, karma doesn't work. But I think that, I know it was one thing when I was a child and I would see these films they would show at the church we went to and the missionaries over in Africa and the children over there that had such hard lives. And I can remember sitting there in church and wondering, gee, Why did God give me such a great life? And look at those little kids. They don't have as good a life as I do. And this isn't fair. I thought God loved everybody equally. At least that's what my parents and my Sunday school teachers used to tell me. So it was very difficult for me to grasp. But I do believe, I've come to believe, that karma is perfect justice. That, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, do things that happen to us, do we consider them bad? I don't know. Maybe it's just what we needed to take that next step on the path,
yeah,
no matter what that is.
Yeah, so a belief in karma could also open us up to a new perspective then.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. In your book, you share a story from the Harry Potter series that's wonderful in helping us understand things we fear. Can you share that?
Well, that was one of my favorite lessons in the Harry Potter books. It was the ridiculous spell. And they were learning how to overcome their fears through the ridiculous spell. So children were called to think of something they feared most of all. And when they thought of it, it appeared. And then they took their wand, waved it toward the thing they feared and said, "Ridiculous!" And the thing disappeared. And you know, I think that's like a good idea, you know. It's like, okay, you conjure up these things that you're most, and most of the things that we're afraid of, we do conjure up in our own mind.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot of stuff that we're afraid of hasn't even happened yet.
Yes.
And we conjure it up. And if we just sat back and went, "Ridiculous, why am I afraid of this?" And, you know, we can just, you know, sometimes you just have to say "ridiculous" and it goes away.
I have a feeling I'd be saying that half a dozen times every day. "Ridiculous." It's almost like George Costanza's dad. "Serenity now. Serenity now." I love that. You know, I forgot that.
Yeah. Learning to dispel our fears is easy once we know they are just illusions. Like all of life. You know, the book is titled "The Illusion of Life and Death" because life is illusion, and so is death. And people say, "Well, how can it be illusion? It's real." It's real. It's just not real in the way you think it's real.
Yeah.
It's like a magician, an illusionist. He's doing real things, but the results are not exactly what you're really seeing.
Yes.
You're seeing one thing. Your mind is telling you, "Wow, that tiger went from the stage up to the top, of a rafter."
Yes.
And you know, so in that way, life is illusory, and so is death.
Yeah, I like that. And one of the things I love about your book, it's a great read. I encourage those listening to pick up a copy because it will help prepare them for their death, whenever that might be. There's a Latin phrase that's gotten a lot of popularity in the last couple of years, and yet it's been around forever. Shakespeare even used it, "Memento Mori." And "Memento Mori" simply means "remember death, remember your death." There's a young Catholic nun. She's in her 30s, and she was a grunge before she became a Catholic, and then she became a Catholic nun. But she's leading this worldwide movement in the Catholic Church on embracing immortality by using "Memento Mori." It's becoming a worldwide movement. I thought, now there's an example of someone else who's not Buddhist, right, who's beginning to try to educate people about embracing their own mortality so when it's their time, they too can have a good death by having a good life.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yes, remember death. I think Seneca would agree with that.
Seneca,
I've
very
quoted,
much so.
Seneca several times.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I think he would agree with that. Remember death.
So "Memento Mori" and "Ridiculous." Those are two takeaways I have right now that I'm going to be using every day. So here's a question. What is the best gift we can give to someone who is dying?
I think the best gift we can give someone who's dying is to allow them to die in the way they need to die.
Oh.
It's a very personal thing. Nobody dies for us. And so we need to be able to, in our minds at least, step back and allow the person to die the way they need to die.
I love that. It's radio. And if I just sit with that for a while because I want to drink it in. Then we call it dead air. So I can't do that. I have to keep talking. But that is so true. Just allow them. Well, it's like allowing people the right to live their life. Allow them their own way to die. Because if we die as we live, and we all live differently, people grieve differently. But it's hard for a lot of families to do that, though, isn't it? That's the reality.
The reality is, it is very hard for families to do that because, again, it's the attachment, it's the ego bond that we have with people, and it makes it very difficult for people to allow the person to, to die the way they need to do. And obviously, this is very difficult for doctors. I mentioned Dr. Hasselhorst, who's a doctor here in Scottsdale, and he says it's very difficult when you've got family members who are begging you to pull out all the stops and save this person.
Yeah.
And yet, as he said, this one elderly gentleman said to him, "Please, just let me go. Tell them I'm okay. Let me go." And I think that it makes it difficult on the person who's dying if people are standing around begging them not to go, "I can't live without you," kind of thing, which again is that insertion of the ego into their process. And what is their process alone?
Right. And it can be selfishness too.
Yeah.
A couple thoughts, given what you just shared, is, and maybe a lot of people know this, but for those who are listening and perhaps have someone who's dying, a friend, family member, what have you, and let's say they're unconscious, please know that even though they're unconscious, they can hear every word you say.
Yeah.
And if you need to talk about business or if you need to talk about some difficult issues, take it outside the room. Please don't do that in front. That drives me nuts when I see people do that. The other thing I also want to share is, people always feel like, well, they have to be there. They can't die alone. They can't die alone. And if we can be there, that's wonderful. But a lot of people have learned, and in hospice we've learned, sometimes they're waiting for you to leave in order to die. And when they die and you're not there, don't feel guilty. They wanted that to happen.
Exactly. Yes, that's what I learned in hospice, too. Don't stand there and fight over the family assets.
Oh, my God. I know.
Because we're always conscious on some level.
Yes.
So don't do that. And just know that the dying process is theirs. The time they die is theirs. And let them be with what is.
The book is called The Illusion of Life and Death, Mind, Consciousness, and Eternal Being. I challenge those who are listening to this interview to check this book out, buy it, read it, and have discussion about it. And by the way, Claire, where can they purchase a copy?
Well, when the book comes out, it can be purchased at any bookseller. You can pre-order it at any bookseller as well. And so I would encourage people, like you said, to read it and maybe have family discussions about it. I think it's important.
Absolutely. And I believe the book is officially going to be released on November 16th. Is that right?
They have moved that back. I just got word today that it's actually going to be available in bookstores December 21st.
Okay. All right. Perfect for the holiday time. I see what they're doing here.
If you've worked at hospice, you know that a lot of people choose the holidays to take
yes.
their leave.
Yes.
So it may be more apropos than I thought.
Always a busy time. And can you share your web address, please?
It's claregoldsberry.com, ClareGoldsBerry, all one word, .com.
Again, the book is Illusion of Life and Death, Mind, Consciousness, and Eternal Being. Claire Goldsberry, thank you so much for writing this, and thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. Once again, the book is The Illusion of Life and Death, Mind, Consciousness, An Eternal Being, the author Claire Goldsberry, and you can visit her online at clairegoldsberry.com. Now, in closing, I'm going to play an encore segment of an interview I did many years ago with an amazing teacher, Rabbi Michael Lerner. He was founder of Tikkun Magazine. So here's a segment of that interview I did with him a few years ago.
Several years ago, you wrote once about a growing global incapacity to recognize the spirit of God in each other, what we call sanctity of each human being, and it's led to what you consider to be a spiritual crisis in America. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's huge numbers of people in our society who feel that they're not ever really recognized. They're only seen through the framework of what can they do for somebody? How can they be of use? It's what I call an instrumental frame or a utilitarian frame. Mm-hmm. People aren't really recognized as embodiments of the sacred.
Well, and that contributes to what you call in every aspect of the culture as the old bottom line.
Yes, the old bottom line says that what really counts is how much you can contribute either directly or indirectly to maximizing money or power for those who control the institutions within which we work.
For our listeners, can you define the left hand of God, what that means?
Well, yes, there's within all of us two worldviews that are in conflict. One that comes from the feeling that we're surrounded by people who are just looking out for the number one, that the only way that you can protect yourself is to get power or domination. So as I call that the power and domination worldview, or the view of power over others, and I'm calling that the right hand. And the left hand is the experience that most of us have coming into the world with a nurturing mother who is taking care of us in the first 2 or 3 years without any reasonable expectation of a return on her investment. She's giving pure love to a child, and most of us would not have been able to survive physically or emotionally without that kind of loving in our first 2 or 3 years. So that's the left hand of. And I call it the right hand of God because wherever we focus our attention, whether it's in receiving God's message or whether it's in looking at any part of reality, we have both of these voices going on. So so when people heard God's voice, they heard it both through the frame of the right hand vision, the domination and control over others vision, and the left hand vision, the one of love and caring and kindness. And so most of us have both of these voices in our heads. Every encounter we have with other people, we're alternating between do we have to get power over this person, or can we trust this person and hope to build a caring and kind relationship with them? The right hand, so this consciousness affects everything we hear, and it's in all of our holy texts, whether those are holy texts of religion, whether they're the holy texts of Marxism or psychoanalysis or feminism. You always hear both voices. And in the religious texts, the right hand of God, I call it the right hand of God and not the power over domination view, comes from the quote in Exodus, where the children of Israel, having just gotten out of the terrible oppression of slavery in Egypt, sing a song to God, and they say, your right hand, God, your right hand is filled with power. And because of that, I've identified the right hand as this power vision of God. And then there are many, many texts in the Bible which alternate, because, of course, the Bible was received by human beings. Might have been dictated by God, but it was dictated to human beings, and human beings can only get the part of God's message that they can get, given their own particular limitations. So sometimes people heard God's voice through the framework of domination and control, the right hand of God, and sometimes they heard it through the framework of love and kindness and generosity, the left hand of God. And both voices are there in our holy texts, both in our religious holy texts and in all other kinds of formidable texts of the cultures.
And what that's about, and you write so well about this, is it's an exchange of a voice of fear to a voice of hope.
Well, if you move to the from the right hand of God to the left hand of God. Now, everybody, as I say, has both voices in their head, but what's peculiar about American society at this historical moment is that if you look at the Bible, the right hand of God was always there to champion the struggle of the powerless against the powerful. Mm-hmm. So it was the Egyptian, the Israelites trying to figure out how in the world are we ever going to overcome the slavery system and the Egyptian empire with all its power. The answer they came up with was, well, there's this God in the universe that gives power to the powerless. And similarly, Jesus and his fellow Jews living in Judea under Roman domination, they're looking at the world and saying, what could possibly make it possible to overcome this huge mammoth empire of Rome? Answer, their right hand of God, the vision of God as this power. But the bizarre thing about what's happened in American society today is that the religious right has taken that vision and it has given it over to the elites of wealth and power, who then, in the name of their connection to God, cut the taxes on the most wealthy people and cut the programs for the poor, support militarism and domination of people around the world. In other words, a total inversion of what the Bible had in mind, because what the Bible was talking about was empowering the powerless to struggle against the empires of power. And what the religious right has done today is to take those same texts and give them to the powerful to empower them to dominate and over the powerless. Mm-hmm. In other words, a complete inversion of what the Bible was really about. And so one of the things that we're doing in this new organization that we've created called the Network of Spiritual Progressives is to challenge the religious right on its misuse of religion and God in order to support the interests of the most powerful in the society and the richest elements in the society against the elements of those who are powerless. And that's one of our goals in this network of spiritual progressives. Another one is to also challenge the religiophobia that exists in some sectors of the Democratic Party and the liberal and progressive world.
And this is really a call across the country and across in the various sectors in this country of a new bottom line, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this is that's the third part of our program. We're calling for a new bottom line in American society, so that instead of judging institutions to be effective, efficient, productive, rational, only to the extent that they maximize money or power, we're saying that when you look at an institution, when you look at a projected piece of legislation, when you look at a corporation, when you look at anything you're assessing, our government, our healthcare plans, our educational system, whatever you're looking at, don't judge it only by does it contribute either directly or indirectly to maximizing money and power, but also judge it by how much it contributes to maximizing love and caring, kindness and generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, how much it enhances our capacity to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, and how much it enhances our capacity to respond to the universe with awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of creation.
You were just listening to an encore segment of an interview I did with Rabbi Michael Lerner. What a great spiritual teacher he is, founder of Tikkun Magazine. And I want to thank my special guest, Claire Goldsberry, for a great book, The Illusion of Life and Death. You can learn more online by going to Claire, C-L-A-R-E, Goldsberry.com. And that's today's program. I want to thank you so much for joining me. I want to thank my engineer, Genesis Brown, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.